Welcome to the Sidelines. I am Matt Dolph. I am here, as always, with my number one partner and my number one sports hub friend, Ty Anderson. We like to ramble and talk about whatever we talk about on sports and whatnot. And I know there's probably some things that are on people's minds, but I like to stick to sports. I like to keep things fun. And so I'm going to talk about one of the most fun topics which is on my mind these days, which is that documentary, The Social Dilemma, on Netflix. Ty, I finally got to finish this thing, and God help us, can we organize an iPhone-burning mass bonfire of smartphones?
I told you this is going to be bad for you. I told you this out of the gate. I said, you need to watch it, but it'll be bad for you.
And well, there's nothing... There were some new things. I guess that they know more about what we do, and they can predict our actions even more than I realize, which is I'm glad I learned something new there. Just on the movie itself, like, I thought the dramatizations were a little much. I thought they could have cut back on that. I thought the whole thing with the whole family going around wasn't. It's just like when you do those things, you're inevitably going to have crappy actors. So I mean, I don't know if they really got their point across with those scenes, but there were a few reenactments that I thought were effective, like with the one girl that like posted like this like fake selfie, this like filtered selfie on Instagram, and got 3, 4, 5 comments saying how beautiful she was and how much she enjoyed that, and then the one person saying she had elephant ears, and that ruined her whole night. And I was like, that's pretty much social media in a nutshell. I could totally feel that pain, where like it's just, you can get all the compliments in the world, but you get the one negative response, and like if you're dealing with anxiety or depression, it's just hard to shake that off, which I totally sympathize with. And it just sucks that like there's a whole generation of kids that are even behind you, because you were born in 89. So I mean, you're not part of this like Gen Z. I had social media my whole life generation. Like, you're not part of that. Like, you at least had a taste of the pre-social media, pre-internet life.
I feel older than I am.
These kids constantly dealing with that crap all the time.
I was born in almost 92, not 89, you freak.
Why am I thinking 89?
I don't know. But I was born in the end of 91.
Oh, right. Yeah, you're not 30.
I'm the same year as Terminator 2. That's how you got to remember that.
But you're – okay.
But you're right, though, in the sense that
– you're still this part of the generation, though.
Exactly. We didn't have the social – like, for us, the closest thing to social media, I think, was, like, the first wave was MySpace in 2005. That's kind of when that started to blow up. But even then, that was more like, I don't know, I think we had more fun than we had trouble on there. And I think, you know, the meanest thing that we would have, I can remember, is we would have people who would make fake AIM screen names, and they would like harass you on it.
Definitely dealt with that. I dealt with that with my own friends.
That's what I mean, yeah. And it was like, but it wasn't to the level of, you know, for example, like I've seen people who have children that I'm friends with on Facebook, you know, older family friends or people, you know, I just knew growing up who have kids, or they have, you know, younger cousins. And they'll talk about these horror stories of like these people who make like TikTok pages or Twitter pages devoted to making fun of this like one person. And I think about that, and I'm just like, holy shit, I'm so happy I didn't grow up in this era, because I think that that's just, it's so bad for so many reasons, obviously. It's just, you know, I do think that it's ironic in the sense that communicating has never been easier, and communication has never been more vicious or worse than it is now. And
yeah, it's never been easier to be a bully. Never been easier to be a piece of trash to another human, you know?
Yeah, exactly. And it's a bummer. I mean, it's just, but... Yeah, I do think that documentary highlighted a lot of the issues that we do face and how we change it moving forward. I hate that everything in life now is becoming more like the internet. And I know that sounds like weird to say, because the internet said a lot of great things, but it seems like everything is now what it's like online. And it sucks, because I hate online communication. I much prefer, you know, real life exchanging of ideas. We're not screaming at each other. We're just talking like people. And it just seems like everything now is just so bombastic and just so over the top that it's like, it drives me nuts, dude.
It does. Yeah. Yeah, instant messenger bullying was a thing that I had to deal with back in the day, and I'm sure a lot of kids did. But you could still sign off and walk away from the computer and do whatever else, go outside, and not have to deal with that. Now it's everywhere, and it's in your pocket all the time. I think, like, they showed the data of, like, how, like, anxiety, depression, suicide, things like that have just skyrocketed since around 2010. Or like 2007 to 2010. 2007 is when the iPhone came out and smartphones blew up. So are we gonna keep pretending that that's not the big reason why this is such a problem? Is that like not like all the problems that you laid out for us, but now it's at our fingertips in our pockets constantly? That's like, I think that is the big problem. A lot of our listeners have kids. Like I know we have a lot of people that enjoy our work that are like a generation ahead of us, and they have kids that are maybe a generation behind us. And I say, like, you guys, I'm not like judging them or anything. I'm just saying, like, it's very important to know what your kids are dealing with in that regard. And like, do your best to sort of help them through that. Cause I don't think it's safe to really like completely shield them or like be a helicopter parent or anything like that. But
yeah,
I just feel like you gotta be engaged with what's going on, because the kids are just going to be a-holes to each other. And I don't know. I don't know how we could teach them to not do that, but it just sucks, man. How connected and intertwined everything is, and how everything's blended together, and how the bully culture is like mainstream now.
Yeah. And for me, I mean, honestly, like, and I'm guilty of this, and I think everyone is, because the very idea of it is, you know, that's what it is, right? Like, you go online and I think you are naturally, subconsciously, you are looking at what other people are doing, and then you're comparing it to your life. You know, you don't want to, but that's what it is, because you're looking at pictures of people on vacation or people interacting with people that you wish you could interact with. And you say, well, shit, why can't that be me? And I think that, you know, what is that saying, right? That comparison is a thief of joy. I mean, that's what your phone is. Your phone is a, you know, 4x3 or whatever it is. Thief of joy, you know what I mean?
Yeah, where it's just, I've never heard that phrase before. It sounds like Confucius or something.
Yeah, I don't know where I first heard it, but I might be messing it up too, but I think that's what the expression is. But you know, and for a lot of people, I think the internet is now, you're constantly comparing yourself to other people, and the internet, I think, can make you feel lonely. I think social media can make you feel lonely, as ironic and weird as that is. And so I you know, that's happened to me. It's happened to people I know. So that's why I try to spend, and I try to spend as little time online as I possibly can. If I'm not sitting at my laptop and writing a column for the website, that is right. I think, because that's just like, I have this crippling fear of like being 75 years old on my deathbed and being like, I spent my entire life staring at a computer. What is wrong with me?
There's so many people that are going to feel that decades from now.
Yeah, and so I'm trying my best not to do that, but yeah, I just think the social media problem is huge, and it's not going away, unfortunately. So it's on us to make it go away, in a sense of just not paying attention, not caring. Send it and go, baby. Send it and go.
It's on us at the end of the day. I do like that the documentary got all of these views from people who worked at Facebook, at Twitter, Google. The former Pinterest president was in there, and like, I do believe them when they say that, like, they went into this with good intentions. I don't think even Zuckerberg, and this, I mean, this whole thing you could say is all Mark Zuckerberg's fault. And I think even he went into it saying, like, that it's just a way for people to interact and have fun with each other and, like, see what their friends are up to and you know, check stuff out. And that is sort of what it, like, I didn't sign up for Facebook. My first foray into social media was Facebook, and that wasn't until 06, which was my freshman year of college, and I thought it was awesome. I thought I was able to keep in touch with people better, and I was able to meet people and all that stuff. And like, I thought that was a good thing. And I think they went into it with good intentions, but the problem is human beings are incredibly flawed, and there's just so many bad people and people with bad qualities and people who act on bad impulses. And we're all guilty of that. I'm not perfect. I do the same crap from time to time. It's just on us to sort of avoid it as much as possible. And yeah, like I've told you before that I'm like buying more like physical books like, if not just to like learn about stuff without having to scroll through the internet, but just look at a piece of paper and just keep my eyes away from the screen. Mm-hmm. You know, minimize the screen time, which is a good thing. And like, yeah, like there are still good things about smartphones that like that makes me not want to completely throw it in the river. Like, it, you know, I can set reminders. I can use my calendar. I can keep up like my list of contacts. There's meditation apps and fitness apps, yoga, like all kinds of things you can do to improve your health. And there's you can meet with a doctor via FaceTime these days, and you can go to therapy that way. You can train yourself to rewire your brain and things like that. There's all kinds of good things you can do with smartphones. It's just, can we get away from the social media? Can we get away from arguing with each other back and forth all day? Like how are you gonna? I don't know how you're not gonna get to your deathbed and wish you did more of that crap. I just don't get how you see how the impulses can draw you in so easily. But you just we have to fight it so much more. I think we gotta fight it.
People chase clout. They chase recognition, because I think that that's one of the things that documentary hit on, is that the like button and the acknowledgement is a dopamine, you know, or it's just like it makes you feel good. And the day you stop giving a shit about all that is the most freeing day of your entire life. I really do believe that. That's just like the day you just stop trying to fight for approval of numbers is big. And I think I'm trying to get there. I think we're all trying to get there. And why I like, you know, not to bring it back to what we do for work. If I always laugh when people bring up, like, you know, if they don't like my opinion on something, they're like, I guess Twitter just gives out check marks these days. And I'm like, dude, I will sell you it for like $500. Like, I don't even care about this is not important to me. But it speaks to the idea of like what we value as important. I don't care about any of that stuff. I just, if I'm doing a good job, all I care about is you know, what my bosses think, what my family thinks, what my friends think, and that's it. That's all I care about. I don't care about numbers or, you know, likes, retweets, whatever. I miss the days of Facebook when you were talking about it being like 2006. I miss the days of Facebook where it was like this page or they're going to start charging us to use Facebook. Remember those pages?
Good one. Yeah, that was the good old days of social media before it became too toxic. No, it's just craziness. But we don't have to talk about that all day. We can, I think we've exhausted that part of the conversation. But I know we harp on it all the time, but it's a very important topic to me. And I just hope people listen to what I'm saying and understand that I'm not judging anyone as a person. I think we all fall victim to the way that these platforms manipulate us. And I think it's important that we just try to at least minimize it, if not get rid of it entirely. Like I've deleted social media off my phone, and I've turned notifications off for any app that's not like, you know, a messenger app or like a reminder app, like things that are important in just day-to-day life. You know, like I just don't need to know, like, this guy commented on that and this guy replied to you, this guy liked your tweet. Like I don't need that anymore at all. I don't think any of us do. And so I'm just trying to start a movement here. Maybe I'm a little ambitious, but I think it's important. So, we can talk about actual sports. Other fun topics like the Tampa Bay Lightning are the Stanley Cup champions. That's another fun topic for Boston people to talk about. We don't have to, you know, get into it too in depth, but I said it going into the playoffs. They were the most complete team. They should win. They should have won the last three cups, really. And they finally get over the hump. And they deserved it. They played the best. They never got to a game seven, which was pretty incredible, I thought. And the Victor Hedman pick has finally paid off for them. Stamkos got a ring, even though he barely played. Kucherov played well, and it looks like they're – I mean, you always talk about they're going to be headed for cap jail or whatever. They're going to have to peel off pieces, but – I mean, what are the chances that next year that they're just as good and they should be the cup favorite next year?
So it all depends what they do here, because I think one of the things that they've done a tremendous job at, especially this year, was adding the valuable depth pieces that were older players who were established, like Pat Maroon, Kevin Shattenkirk, Zach Bogosian midseason, and slotting them into lesser roles and where they could thrive. And I think that made the big difference for them. when you're able to roll out those kind of guys, and then you have a third line that's, you know, Goodrow, Sorelli, Gord, you know,
I love
Blake Coleman. Like, you can move these guys all around, and they're really effective players. So I think that's the name of the game now. It's, you can, you know, for example, right? Like, I was just spitballing today in my head, and I thought, okay, well, if they got to cut salary, who's to say that they can't trade off Curtis McElhinney, their backup goaltender, making, I think, 1.5 mil? Who's to say they can't trade him off for a pick or something? And then they go out and sign one of these veteran goaltenders who just wants to win a Stanley Cup for league minimum. Who's to say they can't do that, you know, every year now and bring it? But it's about finding the right fit, right? Because I think that you can do that. But if the guy is cooked, he's cooked. You know what I mean? Yeah. Like the Blackhawks brought in Chris Kunitz, right, after he was done in Pittsburgh. And it was a fine move in theory, but Kunitz was dumb. And so the Blackhawks really weren't any better for having signed him. And so that's just an example of, I think, a bad fit. But they've been great at finding good veteran fits for cheap. So they're going to have to do that now. They're going to lose. I think they're going to lose a pretty significant piece this offseason. Pierre LeBrun, I believe it was Pierre, wrote today that the threat of an offer sheet is real. You know, that this is a summer where offer for, well, they have Sergachev, he's an RFA. They have Sorelli as an RFA. So they could, in theory, lose one of those guys. But if they don't and they re-sign them, they're probably going to have to trade off either Palat, Tyler Johnson, Alex Killorn, one of those guys. And those are palatable losses for them. They won't kill their team. But it's, who do you bring in to replace them? You know, that is what will be the continuation of their window.
I mean, honestly, if I were the Bruins, I'd offer seat Sergachev. I would love that.
There is a running movement online that you'll notice, and if you ever visit a Bruins forum of some sort, where they want to
cesspools of the internet, friggin' message board. Those are still the true cesspools. That is where the final runoff of the social media muck and scum ends up at the end of the ass end of a message board. Oh my God! I'm all done with message board.
Boston Globe comment section. That is true hell.
Jesus Christ! I don't even.
But I would say that that honestly, looking at their off season and what's ahead. I think that the idea of cap jail is real for them because Vasilevsky makes $9.5 million beginning next season. And that's a lot for a goaltender. And then you look at McDonough and Hedman, who are worth it, absolutely worth it, 100%, are going to be making $15 million combined for the next, I think, 5 or 6 years. And they're entering their 30s now. So you need to have the young guys behind, like Sergachev, to eventually, you know, pass the torch off, or, you know, find the young guys who are on entry level deals that lessen that burden of paying those guys so much money. So it's interesting because I think Tampa, every guy Tampa has is worth it price point wise. It's just they have a lot of really good players, and it's hard to fit all of them in with a hard cap. Yeah.
Yeah, but next year they're gonna have Stamkos, Kucherov, Hedman, Point, Vasilevsky. Like, they're going to have those five guys. I feel like as long as they have those five guys, they'll be squarely in the Stanley Cup hunt. But, yeah, like we said, like, just they got so deep and so complete the last couple of years, it was ridiculous. And so, I mean, good on them for finishing the job, because if they couldn't finish the job with that roster, it would have been a huge fail, in my opinion.
Yeah,
I don't think that's too strong of a take, but they pulled
the
it
franchise
off.
The franchise changes for them, in my opinion, were Yanni Gord and Braden Point. Having those guys come up as centers really changed their fortune, because if you go back to when they were a perennial underachiever in the playoffs, their center situation was not the best. It was Stamkos, but behind that, it was Tyler Johnson, who, you know, he works hard, but he's on the smaller side.
Had a good playoff one of those years, if I remember.
Yeah, correctly. And
when they lost in the finals, right?
Yeah, and behind him, they had Vlad Nemestikov, who pretty good, but not really, you know, a guy that you'd say you're going to win a Stanley Cup with. And they also had Valtteri Filppula from the old Detroit days, who wasn't bad, but he wasn't going to be the difference maker for you, I think, in a Stanley Cup. So replacing those guys with guys like Point and Gord, who can dominate at both ends, and again, Cirelli as well. I mean, that was the franchise changer, in my opinion. It's just having that center depth capable in all three zones is absolutely huge for a franchise.
Yeah, so Tampa's still going to be the team that everybody needs to beat, the team that the Bruins just simply can't get past. But I think because of what we're talking about right now, what we've gone over for the last few minutes, that it could be a little different next year. But obviously depends on the Bruins. And speaking of guys that might be cooked, Bobby Ryan got bought out. And that is the type of player that I have wanted the Bruins to get for a few years now. And I wouldn't be against it might just be a PTO, right? If it might be cheap and they might be able to stick him on in somewhere in the bottom six, or maybe put him next to Charlie Coyle. You seem receptive to that kind of move from what I've heard.
Yeah, I do think he'll get a contract for next season. I do think it'll be sort of a 1 year, 1.5, you know, 2 million. Maybe money's not important because he's still getting paid from Ottawa just on a buyout now versus you know, so I do think that he's going to need to find the perfect fit for him. Mm-hmm. I do think Boston could be that place. When you look at the absence of right shot, right wings, if he came to Boston, he would immediately get a crack with David Krejci or with Charlie Coyle. He would get playing time. And you look at the guys that are challenging him for minutes, it's guys who are not established. It's Andres Bjork. It's Andre Kasha. It's Carson Kuhlman. You know, those guys aren't really going to – it's not like going to Philly and trying to work in their top six. I know Ryan would be interested in Philly if they did come calling. It's his hometown team. That's just an example of a team that, you know, could in theory give him a call. But I do think Boston would be a good fit for him. And I like him not as a savior, but as a guy who actually shoots the puck. I mean, that's right. The biggest thing. He shoots. And we've seen it, you know, in Ottawa. He's a pretty good net front guy. Either, you know, providing the screens or putting away the rebound opportunities, creating rebounds, in fact. He's been pretty good at that as well as career. So I like him in that respect. It's just, you know, how much tread is on the tires? Can they really do that? You know, what does he cost?
My concern would be if they brought him in and then they try to make him the long-awaited right wing for Krejci. I think if they bring in Bobby Ryan, it's got to be third line next to Charlie Coyle. Or nothing, because that would preserve him if he didn't have to play as much. He didn't have to play top 6 minutes, and he plays against, you know, a bottom six line on the other side. Mm-hmm. I think that would bode well for him and bode well for them. I guess we're gonna go right back to Krejci and Kasha next year unless we see a major move out of them. And I know you didn't like how the way Kasha was playing at the end, but I do want to see what he looks like with a full off season camp, you know, all that. Mm-hmm. Under his belt, see, because he looked good at the start. I mean, maybe it was just a matchup thing, because he looked better against Carolina than he did against Tampa, if I remember correctly. But he's another one that I like. I mean, he has a little bit of size to him, forecheck, skates, and I guess maybe he stopped shooting as much as we're used to seeing. This was the issue.
Yeah, that was the problem. He just wasn't firing shots on goal, and he wasn't getting to sort of the high danger areas that he was with Anaheim. So, I don't want to write him off completely. Nick Ritchie, I'll write off completely because I don't see where he fits on the roster.
Get Nick Ritchie out, please. For the love of Christ, can we make an upgrade on Nick Ritchie?
But Kasha, I do think that there is something there. If he can, you know, get his mind right, get his body in shape and be healthy, I do think he can be a difference maker. Is that on the second line or the third line? We'll have to wait and see. But I do think that theoretically he does have the skill set and the smarts to be an impact player. It's just, can he put it all together in time, and more specifically on this team's timeline?
Yeah, I mean, the whole league's been waiting for Roger Kasha to put it all together. So, yes, we'll see. But, I still want to see a big move there as far as a top six winger. And, Bobby Ryan's not going to do it, and I don't think Kasha's truly the answer unless – I mean, maybe you'll prove me wrong, but – feel like you're taking a big risk there if they just go in with the same lineup So I got to see a big move there. On the back end, a lot of Tory Krug news coming out recently. A lot of people were interested in your store and the website about what the Bruins offered Krug. I guess people are just interested in that shit. They're interested in here's what they did offer and what the guy probably won't accept. Because I remember there was a big popular story on our website about the Patriots' final offer to Tom Brady. So, mm-hmm. I mean, not that this is a similar, like, impact kind of player for the Bruins, but Krug is most likely gone. There's the talk of them trading his rights to another team, which, I mean, it's largely inconsequential. They're not going to get a high draft pick, really, for that. But, I mean, if they get a fourth-round pick, I'll be happy. But, yeah, I think 6 years, $40 million, if that was the offer, that was, like, pretty much a perfect offer, I think, for Sweeney, because he can say he tried for the people that really want him to keep Krug around, and it's just not enough for Krug to re-sign here. And if he signed for that, I'd be okay with it. 6.5 for him isn't bad, but if he's going to make over 8, then best of luck, Torrey. I don't personally think he's worth that much money per year, but I mean, good for him if he can get it somewhere else, and I think he will get it somewhere else.
Yeah, I think that's close to where I think my cap was for him, considering where the Bruins are, what they want to do, was around 6.5, 6.75. That just seemed to be the ceiling, so to speak, with that, just because you need to get scoring. You need to add top-tick scoring, and if you're paying a guy $7.5 million, you know, to run a power play, to be a power play quarterback, that's not going to work in terms of you getting that guy.
Right. Trade for Brock Besser and then sign him to that deal. That's
yeah, exactly. And so I do think that the Jeff Petrie contract in Montreal definitely probably shot Krug's value up a little bit.
Oh, God, what's he making?
He signed a deal, I believe it's for $6 million per. And
oh, okay.
So if you look at that and you're Tory Krug, and 5 days later the Bruins say, we think you're worth an extra $500,000 a year. You're going to say, no, I'm worth $1.5 million more than Jeff Petrie. You know what I mean?
$100 million.
Is basically what that is. And I would say that if they do trade Krug's rights, which I think is possible, but I do think they're going to try to make a few more offers, maybe a volley or two, you know, back and forth before they make that deal. The best case scenario is that fifth round pick that the Flyers traded to get Kevin Hayes' rights from the Jets last summer. You're not going to get more than that. You know, you're not going to get a second-round pick or a first-round pick. But if you're going to get that kind of, you know, it needs to be more of a hockey trade. It needs to be a sign-and-trade. And if your team is going to do a sign-and-trade with Tory Krug, the only reason you're doing that is because you want that extra year, that eighth year yes. of the contract. So I don't see Tory Krug being that guy. That teams are going to say, we want to give up a real asset here and a sign and trade so we can have him for that extra year when he's 37 years old. I think that's more likely for a Petrangelo, you know what I mean, or a Taylor Hall. Yeah. I don't think that's likely for Tory Krug, just based on the style of player that he is. So I think that people need to temper their expectations when it comes to a potential trading of the rights. It's not going to be for anything more than a late round pick that the Bruins can just add to their war chest and maybe do something with as a throw in.
Yeah, exactly. I'm not getting my hopes up about the trade at all. I'm just sort of glad that they're not going to sink that much money into Krug, which I know I sound like a hater because I constantly bring up that I don't think he's worth that kind of money. And I think they could stand to just have a different type of player in his spot where I think they could use someone with size, which brought us to the Oliver Ekman-Larsson thing, which we don't have to get into again. But if they could get a bigger defenseman who could kill penalties and clear the front of the net, I think they'd be better off in that spot. But you don't have to spend that kind of money to get that guy. And maybe Lozon could be that guy or something. I think that's what we're going to end up seeing. So big changes coming on the Bruins back.
I don't want Ekman-Larsson. I just want to go back to this real quick because Darren Dreger tweeted what he believes the price would be for Ekman-Larsson. He believes that it would be a first round pick, one of your one of your NHL ready defensemen or close to it. So I think for the Bruins, that'd be Vaakanainen. I think that's where I land on that. Just the best comparison, whatever. Right. And then you need a contract to sort of offset the fact that Ekman Larson's making 8.25 for the next 6 or 7 years, whatever it is. The Bruins don't really have a lot of bad contracts in terms of who they'd give up to get him. The closest is John Moore and Nick Ritchie, which I think combined makes $4 million. You know, it is a 2021 first, Lakanainen, and then those two, or, you know, you want to throw in Anders Bjork?
I just want to see what Lakanainen can do. Can we just see what that kid can do before we trade him for a, you know, an old, like, not that Ekman Larson's super old, but I mean,
mm-hmm.
the amount of money that he's, that you'd have to sink into him, and I don't think he would be like a true, like, put you over the top difference maker for them. Can we just see what Vakanainen can do? Maybe, you know, maybe he's fully seasoned and he's going to be really good. You never know. Maybe he's the answer next to McAvoy in the top pair. Is that maybe. Crazy?
Maybe. I mean, it's.
I figured he's a good compliment for him, but I mean, I don't know, like, maybe he's not ready for that role yet, but I mean.
Well, the problem is that he's a left-shot defenseman. He's been log-jammed for quite a while now based on how many left-shot defensemen the Bruins have. And
right, and we're just going to go right back to – we're just going to add to the log-jam. We're going to renew the log-jam with a more expensive player.
And I wonder, though, I we've talked about this before, I'm pretty sure, is the fact that Zboril needs to make the team next year or he's on waivers.
Yes.
So in theory, that's a guy that's ahead of him on the depth chart right now because of the fact that they don't have options. You still have options with Vakanainen. You don't have that with Zboril. It's either NHL or the waiver wire. So that plays a factor, and we're going to see what that means. I do think that Vakanainen is more along the lines of I think, where the game is going, where the Bruins want to go. He has a little bit of size. He's not a puck mover. You know, he's not going to put up 50 points. But he can make plays. He made a good first pass.
Yeah, is he like a left-handed Carlo, basically?
I think he has a bit more offensive upside than Carlo. But yeah, they seem to think that there's more offense there. You know, whenever I ask about him, they think that they can bring more of it out. And
a little bit better of a puck mover and can skate a little better.
Basically. Yeah, and there.
Well, he skates a lot better. That's his number one thing, really.
Yeah, and there was talk from Jay Leach, the Providence coach, that he ended the year, you know, really putting some good looks on net, some really strong offensive plays, and they want to try to get that dialed up on a consistent basis. When he activates, he's pretty damn good. It's just he needs to activate more. So he's getting a feel for the senses, you know, the ins and outs of the game. So we'll see what he can do. But I do think that he's a year away still, given what they need to find out about Zboril still.
Yeah, I mean, I might sound like a fucking parrot at this point with the way, I think with all these left shot defensemen, these young guys, please no major moves on left side. Just can we decide who we want to keep, or who we want to play, and who we want to get rid of? Just can we find out what these guys can do at this point? It's time. It's time. Lakanainen, Lozon, Grizzlick, someone else I'm probably forgetting. They have enough where I think they can fill them in the lineup. And see what they could Zboril, see what they could do, and figure out who they want to move on from. Let's just do that. Worry about your own guys.
And to your point, exactly. I think that a problem for this organization has been doing that, right? That they've often held on to guys for too long, and then their value is just shot. I mean, look at JFK, look at Peter Solarik, Danton Heinen. Even I would argue that they held on for too long and they hurt his value.
I think Bjork's on his way there.
Yeah,
and even DeBrusque. I mean, unfortunately,
you got to either let him play and see what you got, or move on. And I think, you know, they're so afraid. We've talked about this before. They're so afraid of losing more young talent that they almost bury their young talent and then they move on because they want to move on, not because that they had to, but because, well, what else are you gonna do? They're not NHL quality anymore. So that is worth mentioning. I do think I think we're beginning to see it at the NHL up front, rather, with the Fredericks, the Sinishins, the Kuhlmans, the Bjorks, as you mentioned. I think now we're going to see it on the up front, with how they're managing some of these guys. I mean, what is their ceiling? What can they do? Can we see it? You know, because doing it for two games here and there for 9 minutes isn't going to do it.
Yeah. I think another topic I want to get to, though, with you is Jack Eichel. We can get back to this every week if we want, because he's that good of a player.
I like it.
What can you tell us about that? I know I feel like you've had some birdies talking about that, but how likely is it that they make a move like that? Like, this is the kind of thing where, like, it gets the Twitter zombies going, like, oh, can you trade Rask and Krejci for Eichel straight up, please? It's like, no.
I saw hilarious. No, there's a hilarious
no, guys, no. But, like, just say for the sake of this discussion that they do find a taker for David Krejci. And so they can clear that spot in the roster and the cap and whatever, and they can make a move for Eichel. How likely is it?
Well, that's the big one, right? Because that's what? That's $7.25 million that you clear off the books, which makes his, you know, Eichel's $10 million far more palatable. So that's the thing, right? That if you're going to bring in Jack Eichel, you need to move on from David Krejci in some fashion, whether that's waiting a year until he's off the books and making the move then. But this would cost you an absolute ton. I mean, this would be the biggest trade in franchise history in terms of what you'd pay to get him. I'm completely confident saying that when you consider the following that
no, we're talking the biggest trade ever. There's no question about that.
Yeah. And not only that, it's Buffalo has a new GM. And if this is the move that he's going to make, this is going to define his tenure. So if you lose this trade, you know, you basically are dooming yourself a year into the job. And so they need to make sure that they win this trade or come damn close to it. Now, the problem with that is that if you are acquiring Jack Eichel, it's to put him with David Pastrnak or with Charlie McAvoy, not to do a one-for-one swap. So you wouldn't trade those guys to bring him in. But that's what Buffalo is going to say. They're going to say, we want one of these guys. And you're gonna have to say, no, we'll give you Carlo, Stadnica, John Beecher. We got these guys too. Do you want them? You know, and that makes it a lot harder, I think, because I think that Bruins fans, unfortunately, are accustomed to losing trades so much so that they go, well, look at it. Look what we gave to get rid of Joe Thornton. Look what we gave to get rid of Tyler Seguin. It's like, yeah, and that's a problem. You don't want to do – other teams don't want to do that. Right. You know, so I think we feel owed one, rightfully so, but it's not realistic to expect that to be the case for multiple reasons. But also, Eichel, if he's available, the bidding war will be – legit. You have New York. New York is coached by David Quinn, his old coach at BU. And if you look at the Rangers, what they've done over the last 5 years, I would say, just piling up assets. I mean, they have so many prospects, so many picks, you know, so like they have so many things they could do to make a great offer Buffalo's way. And let's just begin with this, right? That last year they drafted Kaapo Kakko second overall. Right now they have the number one overall pick. They could, in theory, offer one of those guys up to Buffalo. You can't match that. You have nothing that can match that in your prospect pool. I mean, that's such a good chip to have here, the Rangers. So I look at that I think that's a team to watch. And outside of them, Colorado interests me because they've, you know, they have that ability to go for it, to have the load up. I wonder when they need to make that move though.
That would be nuts.
No, but that's the thing is that they have the ability to kind of cash in, right? If they have all the chips now, and how do you cash in? Do you cash in by retaining your own talent or do you go for the home run? So that's an option for them as well. I think that there are legit suitors. And so the Bruins would have to have an incredible package, to bring him to Boston. And I don't know if they got that. I don't know if they got that, you know, at the end of the day. But I will tell you this, that they were in contact with his camp and sort of saying, all right, what's the deal here? You know, what's going on? Whether anything comes of it, we'll see. But I've heard that there was communication this summer.
Eichel for the number one pick when that pick is like a, you know, the next like Jack Hughes or whatever. That would be a real doozy if that happened.
I think the Rangers should do it. It surprises me that there hasn't been more talk there, that the Rangers could say to them, you know, listen, we have Keandre Miller, who's a great prospect, and we got the first overall pick, and we got some bad contracts we could sell you to. You know, like that surprises me that there has been more chatter about that this offseason.
Well, maybe it happens. We'll see. Yeah, that's, I mean, the way you've laid it out doesn't sound very likely. That they'd have to make a severe overpay, especially if they're not going to be able to give up Pastrnak or McAvoy, which I don't think anybody wants them to do. But Pastrnak and McAvoy need to be part of the future here.
Yeah.
And trading one of them for Eichel wouldn't really help.
Well, we talked. I wrote about this earlier this summer that the Eichel trade idea or bringing to Boston is a fantastic idea, and I've felt that way for a long time. But the timeline right now is just not working in their favor. I always viewed Eichel as sort of the John Tavares, right? That he was going to leave Buffalo and come to Boston as a free agent. Mm-hmm. Bergeron be older, you know, Marchand be older if they were still playing. And it would be it would allow them to have that organizational reset where now the core is Eichel, Pastrnak, McAvoy, and whoever else. But 2020, 2021, that's not the time to get Jack Eichel because of everything else we've talked about. It's just not. It just doesn't seem realistic to me. So, and the fact that he might get traded to a team that he might like a lot better than Buffalo anyway hurts that idea as well because he might just say, "I'm not going anywhere. I like it here." You know, so that's a problem as well.
You shall see. I mean, that's just the running theme. It's going to continue to be. Bruins need to make a major move, whether it's, you know, go for the Eichel trade, trade for a big name top six winger, then sign him to a long-term deal, get a big defenseman in here. Like, that, something big needs to happen. Something big needs to change, or else it's going to be the same exact result. Second round, run into Tampa, and they run you out of the building. Really sick of watching it. That is my personal feeling. I think I speak for a lot of Bruins fans when I say that.
You do. You absolutely do.
Yes, I do. I do. I want to move on now to our local basketball team, which is another disappointing result in this city. And guys, I get it. I'm not a basketball expert. You want me to stick to hockey, stick to Patriots, whatever, stick to social media being terrible. But I don't think I'm wrong when I say that the core of this team, which is really just like Jason Tatum and Jaylen Brown, they're not at the level they need to be at to win a championship. But it's not a knock against them. It's just the reality of the NBA. Dude, nobody wins the title with a bunch of 22 and 23-year-olds, especially not with them as like the leaders of the team and like the best players. It just doesn't happen. I mean, even when Kobe won, he had Shaq. When Kawhi Leonard won the NBA Finals MVP at age 24 or whatever it was, he had Tim Duncan and Monta Ginobili and Tony Parker. Incredible veteran core that knew how to win. And, of course, Greg Popovich. I don't think Brad Stevens is the problem. I know he gets a lot of criticism for the way they play. I think it's just a personnel and a makeup thing. I think if there's any one player that could be the issue on the team, I think it's Marcus Smart. And I hate to say that because I love Marcus Smart. I love the way he plays and his energy and all that stuff. But when he's taking more shots than Jaylen Brown and Kemba Walker and what their season on the line, like he's not a shooter. I think if he really thinks he's this like lights out shooter who's going to close out games, he's wrong. And I think that's a bad mix for them. And I think if they traded Marcus Smart this offseason for a center, I think that would improve the mix. And I think him thinking he's like the leader and being the guy that like, I'm going to bring these guys along and I'm going to show them how to win and how to close, that's a mistake. He's never won a damn thing. They have nobody on the team who's won anything. And I think if they got Andre Iguodala instead of the Heat, that might have been all the difference they needed to beat the Heat. And I think losing to the Heat is an underachievement. And but I just think that this team right now wasn't ready to make that next step. I think they should have made the finals with the way that the competition lined up for them. But just the makeup and the mix of the team right now is not what you need. I think they need either a few veterans who know how to win or just make an upgraded center. I think Daniel Tice and Dennis Kanter, platooning at center is not good enough. It's maybe too much to ask to say they need like a Bam Adebayo type, but you need a guy like that who can make an impact at center. I think it's just not enough. And I mean, rant over what you covered the Celtics way more closely than I did in that final series because I've been busy covering the Patriots. But I think just big picture, if they think they're going to win a championship with Tatum and Brown at this stage of their careers, they need to bring in more veterans who know how to win and know how to close and have rings and could put them in their place, so to speak. So what are your thoughts?
Yeah, I really wish that they got somebody for the bench. sort of an Iguodala type like you were talking about, I think would be huge for this team. I look at sort of what Miami had rolling off the bench with Tyler Hero, who would have been a great pick for the Celtics if he lasted one more pick. But I would also say that you know, they could have used the, you know, and Kanter, I mean, Tyson Kanter played well. I thought that Tyce was great in their game five.
Yeah, it's not that they didn't play well. It's that they're just they're much better off at the end of the rotation than the beginning of it.
Exactly. Yeah, and so I do wish that they made more of an impact on the buyout market. There was talk of Marvin Williams back when that was a thing, but the truth is that when you add a guy at the buyout market, and we saw this with Greg Monroe, they're not going to play a ton because they're jumping in late. They don't really know the system. They don't really know the team. So I look at Danny Ainge and I say, okay, this offseason, try to bring in some veteran scorers here, some guys who can come in. You know, like, for example.
Guys who have won.
An example for me would be J.J. Redick. You know, maybe not now, but 3 years ago, J.J. Redick. You need something like that who can pop in off the bench, pop in, you know, go five for eight on three-pointers, and then go back to the bench. You need something like that. I think that would be a massive boost for this team. And when it comes to the whole big situation, I think Robert Williams looked pretty good in this postseason when you gave him time. I think he needs more time, though. I want to see how he plays as a full-on starter, because I think that ultimately you have a lot riding on him, right? Because if he doesn't work out, okay, now you're back to looking at the trade market for, you know, the next big thing.
Yeah, I don't know if they necessarily need a stud or whatever at that position. Like, maybe no. Robert Williams takes a step forward, but like, I'm just looking at the free agents: Tristan Thompson, Marc Gasol, JaVale McGee. Three names that aren't gonna, you know, blow you away, but guys who have won, guys who have experience in this situation, and theoretically they could play both ends. They could start, and you know, I feel like those. I would like it if they brought any of those guys in.
Yeah, I like that idea. I do. I was almost surprised that they didn't dip into the free agent market upon the restart when they were given that second chance. You know, that hey, you could bring in somebody else here. I think that Brad Wanamaker plays a nice game, but do I want him being the number two?
It's the same thing as Tice. It's like, okay. Is this enough to make this guy your number two point guard? You know, like if they had a veteran there or a sharpshooter like J.J. Redick instead, they'd be much better off.
Yeah, and that's a perfectly reasonable way to look at it. And you look at what other teams have done in terms of adding, you know, pieces like that. It's not making the complete difference, but it has helped. I would say it's helped when it's hurt in a lot of these instances. So I just think that they need to become more of a draw for some of these free agents who are trying to win, and maybe that's hard for them. You know, I feel like we've talked about this for a while with this team, is that, well, they want to get this guy, but they're going to lose out on getting him to LA or to Miami or to wherever. So it's kind of an interesting problem to have, but clearly watching this postseason, I feel like you need a little bit more veteran pop or just scoring pop in general off the bench.
Yeah.
If you can draft those guys, awesome. But if you can't, you know, I feel like there's always a free agent available that would make a little bit of sense for you if you integrate them at the right timeline.
Yeah.
It's just, I don't want to waste 60 games of saying, oh, well, they don't have a lot of bench scoring, but if they add someone now, are they really going to play a lot? It's like, well, that can't be the only two ways to look at it. There has to be another way to look at it and say, well, how can you address that? Yeah. You know, it's having two extremes, if you will. So, I'm curious what they do, but they need more scoring pop off the bench, I think, clearly.
Yeah, it depends on how they feel about Tatum and Brown in the short term. Like, if they say that we can win a championship with these guys as our one and two scoring and whatever, our go-to guys, Tatum could be the closer. If they say that we can win with these guys in the next, you know, 3-4 years, whatever you want to call it, then they have to add what you're talking about. They have to surround them with enough with the overseas free agents who have no NBA experience. Like, you've got to get guys who have played more in the playoffs that can sort of help them along and be that spark off the bench. and lead in the ways that these guys don't know how to do because they're just young and they don't have the experience. It's nothing against them. Like, I think the trade Tatum, trade Brown, trade like anybody, unless you're trading Marcus Smart or Gordon Hayward, it's not an idea I want to entertain. That is where it gets loony to me. Like, I don't know how much of that there was on Twitter. You probably saw more of it than I did. Well, was there trade Tatum talk like this guy sucks? Come on, guys. He's not. Can we not write off Jason Tatum at age 22?
There was more trade Brown talk, which I found more offensive, to be honest with you. I will say this is that I think that you can absolutely win with Tatum and Brown. I think Brown is you know, watching him this postseason, looking at the way he carried himself, the way he, you know, they handled the post-game, you know, brouhaha, if you will, with Marcus Smart after they lost to the Heat. I think Brown is emerging as a legit leader on this team. I really do believe that. And what I like about Brown is I think that he's more of the quiet assassin type where he'll make a big shot and he just looks at you and keeps on playing. And
he seems like he has the feel of a closer.
Oh, yeah.
Clutch shot type of guy.
Absolutely. And
if he doesn't have as much upside or he's not as dynamic as Tatum.
Yeah. And Tatum,
it feels like he has that mentality, which is good.
Tatum is incredible. And I like watching him play. One thing that drove me absolutely crazy this summer, every time he even slightly got touched, he was barking at the referee demanding a call.
Oh, that's been a thing.
And it's just like, dude, you got to keep on playing. Like, and I felt that there were times where he got in his own head looking for calls and waiting for the call and waiting for the bailout.
Dude, just give it time. If you reach your potential, you're going to start getting those calls. So just be patient.
Meanwhile, you know, Jaylen Brown is knocking down threes and blowing kisses at the Miami bench. You know, that's kind of the swagger that I want to see versus the whiny, you know, almost makes you look, you know, a little weaker. You know, if you're in opposition and you're looking at Jason Tatum crying to the refs every time, you're saying, hey, I think we can get under this guy's skin if we keep this up.
Right, you know, yeah, I feel like mental. Everybody does that. You know,
no, I know. NBA thing. Yeah, you know, maybe that's me looking at it from the wrong angle. I'd like to see a little bit more mental toughness out of this team in some of these key moments. And I also want to see, you know, Stevens get back to being that coach that always had the play, right? He always had the play the first few years with the undersized, under-talented rosters. He always had the perfect play to win them a game. And I didn't like some of the decisions that he made in this series, the Miami series. I thought some of their final possessions with the game on the line were terrible. So I want to see him, you know, get back to his roots of being that mastermind coach that, you know, outwits the other guy.
He definitely got out-coached by Eric Spoelstra, but I mean,
big time.
I don't know. I'm just of the opinion that it all matters is the stars. It doesn't really matter who your coach is. You could put Alf in there, a coach, and it would be totally fine.
I want that. I'd really want that.
put your pants back on, Jesus.
You're gonna have Nick Nurse be the coach. I mean, he's basically a cartoon character.
That picture you tweeted was hilarious.
Of him giving birth to a bowling ball? Yeah,
that
was great.
The shape of his thighs in that picture you sent was
yeah.
The more I looked at it, the funnier it got.
He's a lunatic. He is insane. He's an insane person. But you know, you bring up the whole coaching. It's talent that wins, right? Think about next year. Just think about next year in the East with Milwaukee, Miami, obviously, what we've seen this year. Philadelphia's probably going to get a better coach. We're going to see how that plays out. And then you have Kevin Durant and Kyrie Irving. And if they can add someone to that team in Brooklyn, now they might be the favorite. So it's not going to get any easier. I'm just, you know, that's one thing that I'm curious what you think about, you know, in terms of, we talk about the window, right, and how young they are.
Yeah, I don't know, this might come off a little contrarian, but I'm not quite as worried about the Durant-Irving combo. Durant's coming off, like, another major injury. How much longer is he going to be, like, unstoppable, like, superstar? Because he's not built like LeBron. He's wiry. Like, how much longer is he going to have that same explosion and sharpness that we're used to seeing? Is it crazy to suggest that Tatum will be better than Durant in a year or two, maybe even next year? I don't think that's too crazy to suggest.
No, it all depends how he responds from the Achilles injury, because we still haven't seen John Wall. This happened to John Wall like a year and a half ago. He didn't
I forgot he existed.
That's what I mean. And so this is an injury that I would have to think long and hard to think about a guy who's come back from this. Because off the top of my head, I can't think of anybody. I think did Ryan Anderson have this injury? But that, you know, even that he's not Durant. Right. You know, there was somebody who had this injury who I'm forgetting right now. I apologize.
If it's a bad injury. And look, I get it. Like, Durant's one of the best players ever, really. He's probably might be top 50 all time at this point.
I would say
I just don't know how much longer he's on the wrong. He's into his 30s, and it's just a bad injury to come back from. I want to see it first before I act like Durant and Kyrie are automatically going to be that much better than the Celtics. You know?
And his co-pilot is a crazy person. So
exactly. He's going to be as well. Yeah, he's going to be flattening the Earth and, you know, getting into all kinds of conspiracy theories. You know, Felger was scaring the crap out of me the other day, saying, "Oh, he's probably calling Jason Tatum, saying, come join us." Hopefully Tatum's like, "No, I'm just humoring him because he's crazy." You know, I'm giving him the call, so he'll leave me alone for a month. You know?
That Tatum comment worried me a little bit, though. Not gonna lie, because I'm terrified in general of all NBA players leaving.
Tatum, what did Tatum say?
They asked him about his contract extension. And he said, "I'm not thinking about that right now," which I didn't have a problem with. But then he said, "When that happens, I mean, if that happens," I was like, "What do you mean if that happens? That should happen. Why wouldn't that happen?"
He wants to leave open the possibility that someone else could get him.
Yeah, which terrifies me.
Drive up his price as much as possible. That would just suck.
Yeah,
just lose him. He just goes. Yeah. He just leaves. Like,
that'd be awful.
That would be unreal. You know? Just got to give him the bag. Just give him $45 million a year or whatever the hell Chris Paul got.
Well, he was part of the All-NBA third team this year, which means they can offer him, I think, another like percentage point or two higher percentage of the cap. So I think that equates out to another, you know, I think $4 or $5 million a year, something like that. So that helps them in that regard.
They just lose him.
Yeah.
That'd be so bad. It's like funny.
Oh,
they finally find a franchise player. He just leaves after his rookie deal is over.
Oh, I really.
It's pretty masochistic of me to just crack up at that, but that's just.
Crazy. Well, that's the thing. Like, I feel like you're tempting fate, and it's like terrifying me. Like, dude, I'm like, we gotta stop talking about this. It's
all right. We can move on. We can talk about the Patriots. We're 57 minutes in, and you know we haven't even talked about the football team, which I've been balls deep in. And
they're all right, huh? They seem okay.
They look pretty good. But, I mean, like, the thing about them so far is that, like, they've beaten the bad teams and they've lost to a really good team. So, if they lose again to the Chiefs this weekend, like, I don't think it would be unfair for the 8-8, 9-7 people to say, see, this is what they are. This is what they're going to be.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, I want to see them really show up and I want to see them give Mahomes some trouble, which is, I think, might be too much to ask. But, I was laughing at that game last night with the crazy amount of trick plays and all the pre-snap. I charted it. They had used some sort of pre-snap motion 56 times out of 75 offensive snaps. Now, I don't know if that's just a normal rate for like a West Coast offense, but it just seems absurd with the amount of movement they have before the snap. It's like, why can't you guys have the talent, just line people up and just run them down the field. You know, you have the speed, you have the quarterback, you have all that stuff. And, like, yeah, and I joked about it on Twitter, and, of course, a few people thought I was ripping Bill Belichick, which is like, you guys obviously just don't know shit about me. If you think I'm out here questioning Bill Belichick, saying you should be scared of Andy Reid. Like are you
okay? I tell everyone I know that. You always say that.
I might be the most pro Belichick writer in the Patriots media. Like I support most of the moves he makes. I said going into the season over and over again that they are going to win games because they have Bill Belichick. Bill Belichick is the biggest matchup problem in the league. The fact that Andy Reid might be the second best coach in the league just speaks to how incredible Bill Belichick is. and is the reason that I think he is going to have them prepared as much as he can for the Chiefs offense. And I think if the Chiefs offense scores on them, it's just going to be a tip your cap. They have so much talent. There's, you just can't completely stop it sort of thing. I don't think Bill Belichick is just going to get out coached. Andy Reid does have success against them though. They beat you last game and they're the defending champions. So quit your crying.
Why did you spray paint Andy Reid owns Bill Belichick on Patriot? Why did you do that?
I told you that's not true. that was a mistaken identity. I don't even know what spray paint is. I don't know what that is.
I do. I can't wait for this game because I just thought.
I just thought it was. I was just trying to joke about the amount of trick plays. It's like he's reaching all the way into the bag of tricks, pulling out a piece of lint here and an old penny there. It's like, oh, let's make him get ready for this. Because it's like, he looks at Bill Belichick. He's like, oh, God, this guy's going to be ready for everything. We gotta make sure we throw as much shit against the walls of Gillette Stadium as we possibly can, because we need to try to make his head spin and make him wear out that old hoodie as much as possible. That was all I was saying. That's my mistake for thinking people would find something humorous on Twitter. So
I watched. I was watching the hockey game when the Ravens Chiefs game was going on, but I did see one screenshot of a formation from the Chiefs, and I was like, "That's illegal." I've never seen that.
When they had four receivers stacked on top of each other, was it that?
Yeah, one? And I was like, "That's the flying V. You can't do that." I've seen that.
Really is like, how the hell is that even legal?
I was just like, "That's." I thought somebody was like, you know, messing with it, like they like freezed it and they moved the guys back, you know, like Photoshop or whatever. But no, that was a real thing they did, huh? That was what they actually did.
How could you? Yeah, I don't know how it is legal that you could just take like literally all of your skill players and have them line up behind each other. That just seems crazy to me.
They had Andy Reid on, like, hey, you can't be on the field.
I mean, John Harbaugh probably thought the touchdown pass to the left tackle was illegal.
That's right. Yeah,
it was clearly deception. It was an illegal play, and hopefully the league will take a look at that. And then next year he throws a touchdown pass to Marshall Yonder, and he's like, well, you know, we had that in the playbook for the last 3 years or so, and finally saw an opportunity to bust it out.
Is he your most hated coach in the NFL?
Oh, he's so annoying. I don't know if he's my most hated. I'd have to think about that.
I would say that he's definitely number one for me.
If his brother was still in the league, probably.
Like,
Jim Harbaugh threw tantrums even more often than John Harbaugh did.
Like, for me, the coaches that I'm not crazy about in the NFL, I really don't like Bill O'Brien. I'm not big on.
I don't hate him, but I do find it annoying. I find it annoying how conservative he is and how like just stupid the play calls are.
I think that's where I line with him.
Frustrating.
Yeah, and beyond that, it's hard for me to think, like, because a lot of the guys, like, I don't full on be like, oh, you're the worst. Like with Harbaugh, I really do think he's just the worst. I think the other guys that I don't like are more like, you are so bad at this. How do you do this? How is this your job? Like Adam Gase with the Jets. I'm like, this guy is going to ruin this quarterback.
I think
Sam Darnold is pretty good.
I think they're tanking for Trevor.
Jets. Yeah, I think the Broncos are tanking for Trevor. I think that's a big thing.
That wouldn't be surprising at all.
Yeah. Like you're looking at, what's his name? You know, Von Miller gets hurt, and I think that they were like, all right, let's just not do this.
Let's just,
you know,
sign Blake Bortles. Screw it.
Yeah, and then Jarrell Casey has the injury. You know, I'm not going to accuse the team of faking injuries, but they're probably, nope, this is broken. You got to go. He's like, I have a headache. Like, nope, IR for you. You are done for the year, good sir.
We got the Tank Bowl tomorrow night, by the way. They'll probably tie.
Oh yeah, just
they'll just
more ties.
They get to overtime and then just punt back and forth every play.
they try a 98-yard field goal. Like, what are you doing?
They just put the ball in a guy's hands and shove him into the end zone.
Yeah, I'm curious. I'm curious what's going to happen with that game. Seems like a truly miserable viewing experience for everyone.
Tankapalooza. Well, I think the Broncos will win 42-0 because the Jets are just that bad. I think.
Yeah, that's fair.
But back to the Patriots. Yeah, I think I don't think there's – I mean, you could. There's a lot of complicated stuff you could talk about with the way that the Chiefs' offense is run and all that. And, like, what are the Patriots going to do offensively? Because they've had, like, three different types of offensive game plans, which I think they wanted to do. And I think Josh McDaniels loves that he can do this now. Now that he has Cam Newton, that they could literally do anything. They could have him run it, have him throw it. They could do a traditional running game with like they did against the Raiders. So I think, but I think it's going to come down. I think it is going to be a close game that comes down to final 2 minutes, and it's going to be who manages the clock better, which most likely Bill Belichick will outmanage Andy Reid in terms of that, and which quarterback makes more plays. And so I know that's a simple-minded way to look at it, but I think that's what it's going to come down to is can Cam Newton go toe-to-toe with Patrick Mahomes, and who's going to hold on to the ball and get the ball last and score that last touchdown? I think that's going to be the key to the game.
Yeah, I'm curious to see what happens with the Patriots running game here too. It feels like we've seen that they have 280-something yards of total offense last week. Their running game as a whole. Damian Harris seems like he's coming back, right?
At practice. Him and Gunnar Olszewski were back at practice, so there's a chance. They have 21 days to activate them, so they might not actually be activated to the roster this week, but there's a chance.
But there's also James White was back at practice as well.
James White's back, yep.
So that's two more running backs after a week in which he ran for almost three – or had – almost 300 yards of total offense from your three running backs. So they have options there. I'm curious how it happens and curious what happens here if the Chiefs get a Chiefs-like game and they're able to put some points on the board and you're chasing them, how does the air attack return? Because I don't think that Cam Newton had a particularly great game, in terms of passing. It wasn't really in the game script. As it emerged, but I don't think he had a great game in terms of ball placement. There's a few bad passes, I thought, to Edelman. He had that terrible interception. I thought that was a terrible interception.
No, totally. Cam Newton didn't have a good game.
Yeah, so I want to see how he bounces back and what happens there.
He took complete accountability for the interception, which was good.
Yeah.
But, Bill Belichick was actually asked about the time of possession, playing keep away. Mm-hmm. With Patrick Mahomes and that Chiefs offense, he said something to the effect of, "Yeah, but scoring points is the most important thing, especially against the Chiefs." So like, they could put together a 9-minute run the ball down your throat, bully ball, touchdown drive, but then Patrick Mahomes can run you down the field in a minute and make it look easy.
Incredible, yeah.
And so like, the important part is that they're going to have to keep putting the ball in the end zone, and they probably will. Try to control the clock as much as they can, but I think they understand that they're going to have to make plays in the passing game at some point, especially if they go down. You don't want to go down against the Sovereign. They're going to have to – I think they'll try to run the ball and use that running offense as much as they can while the game's close. But, like, if they get down 10, they're going to have to start airing it out. So
exactly.
That's it will be interesting to see how the game starts. I think it is going to start slow. I think both teams are going to – feel each other out for a little bit. It'll feel sort of like a Super Bowl type of game where teams are feeling each other out in the first quarter. It's low scoring, but then it'll sort of open up. I think that's sort of how it's gone in really every game since Patrick Mahomes has emerged between the Patriots and Chiefs. So that will be fun to watch. It's going to be Nance and Romo yet again. Patriots might as well put those guys on the payroll at this point. They might as well just be the team TV broadcasters. That's what they want to do every week. So I'm looking forward to that. Anything else you want to get to before we get out of here, Ty?
I'm curious what's going to happen. I mean, we don't have to get into this a ton, but if you saw today, Mayor Marty Walsh said that we're heading towards the red in terms of the coronavirus pandemic.
Is that bad?
That's not good.
Red bad.
Red equals bad.
Okay.
I'm curious, though, what it means for the state, and particularly keep in mind that tomorrow is October 1st. The Patriots obviously suspended having fans at Gillette Stadium for the first month of the season. Tomorrow's a new month. And Boston is headed towards the red. Now, what does that mean for the state in terms of letting fans back in Gillette? Because I do think that you're beginning to see some of these teams open up their doors a little bit with fans. Mm-hmm. It's going to create a little bit of a home field environment. I mean, it's not like playing at, the Link or Arrowhead with 100,000 maniacs, basically. But you're going to start seeing these other cities, I feel, open up their doors a little bit more. So I'm curious what happens here with Gillette in terms of getting fans back in the stands. The Patriots have handled it well. But I'm curious if and when we're going to see fans back at Gillette this year.
As someone who's commuted back and forth for two games now, keep the fans at home all season for all I care. Oh. That was just a breeze of a commute. No, I'm joking.
You media scumbag.
No, speaking from my experience, I feel incredibly safe going in there. You know, everybody's following the mask protocol, and you complete the wellness assessment going in, so you're holding yourself accountable. They take your temperature, all that stuff. I think they should start letting fans back in. Like, I know the number, like the cases are going up, I guess. Mm-hmm. I mean, I'm not an expert, but I'm not trying to downplay the virus or anything, but I just feel like that's a product of increased testing. Test positive rate is still around 1%. And I know it's still something we need to be cognizant of, but just keep following the protocols that we have in place. And I think they could start slowly letting people back in. And I think Mark Bertrand said it on Zoe Bertrand the other day. I forget what triggered the idea in his mind, but he said that the Patriots said something that he thought indicated to him that they are going to start letting fans back into the stadium. Maybe for week five against the Broncos. So, but I mean, I guess that's a week away. So maybe that's a little too soon. Week seven, I guess they have a bye in week six. So week seven is when they're home against the San Francisco 49ers. That's going to be a big game, and they might want fans back in for that one. So I think that would be, if anything, that would be the target date for them.
What do you think the process is going to be? Because the building, I'm pretty sure, is pretty much all season ticket holders, right? So if you only are allowed, you know, let's say 10% of the building, so you're allowed just under 7,000 fans, what is the process? Is it a lottery? Is it like how do they do that? I'm really curious how that all plays out.
Yeah, I mean, that's for them to figure it out. That's above our pay grade.
Yeah.
Figure it out. That's what I would say.
Well, I would say that they do a field goal kicking contest, and the best person gets a Nick Foles job. The worst person, they don't get to go to a game until week 17 against the New York Jets. Sorry, that's how it is.
Yeah.
That's your one
Jets
game
fans
of the year.
Not allowed in the stadium for the rest of the season. They're all like, good!
That's what I would
think. The Jets suck. I love it. They're probably going to get Trevor Lawrence, so we'll see how that turns out. Thanks for listening, guys. If you made it this far, thanks. I love you. Please rate and review. We had another nice review. Sorry, I forget your name, but it's titled Great Duo, and I thought that was a very nice review. Thank you very much. Positive reviews only, 5 stars only. Thank you very much. It's the Sports Hub Sidelines podcast. It's me. It's Ty Anderson. Thanks for listening, and we'll talk to you again next week.
BackstageCountry.com, your online home for all things country music. Like most fans of country music, we're excited to learn that Luke Combs was back in the studio working on his next album. We've come up with our list of iconic Luke Combs music videos. Yes, Lovin' On You made the cut. Text Luke to 45911 to see if your favorite made the list on BackstageCountry.com. Text Luke to 45911 and we'll send the link straight to your phone.